Yes, we'll start at the beginning. Of course, the very beginning is that we're by nature spiritual beings. But somehow or other, from a very remote time in the past, we have come into the material world. And so our original spiritual nature is covered. The example is given that when water falls from a cloud, it's pure, but then when it, you know, falls on the ground, it becomes contaminated or dirty. So we are all originally pure, but having come into the material world, our original consciousness has been covered. In our original consciousness, we are all we all have an eternal relationship with the divine, with the supreme. But again, when we come into the material world, we forget our eternal relationship. And the real goal of life is to revive our original spiritual consciousness and our relationship with the Supreme. So we don't know how many lifetimes we've passed in the material world. Now, I have a book here called the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita is the essential text on yoga or on Indian spirituality in general. Bhagavat refers to the Supreme, and Gita means song. So Bhagavad Gita is the song of the Supreme, because when he speaks, he doesn't just speak ordinary prose, but he speaks a beautiful song. And the Bhagavad Gita explains that our identity is that we're not the body, but we are the Atma within the body. And the Bhagavad Gita further explains that Krishna, the Supreme, has two energies: the material energy and the spiritual energy. And the Atma is spiritual, and the body is material. And when the Atma, the body is like a machine, not like a machine, it is a machine. Many of you are biology students. So the body is actually a machine, and the Atma is the living force that animates the machine. And when the Atma leaves the body, we say that the body is dead. But actually, the body is always dead. It only appears to be alive because of the presence of the Atma. So when the Atma leaves the body, where does it go? Yes, that was one important point I should have mentioned. that the spiritual energy is eternal, which means it has no beginning and no end. That means we, the Atma, have no beginning and no end. But the material energy, although the totality of the material energy is conserved, but the, you could say the creations of the material energy are temporary, including our body. Most likely, in 100 years, 200 years, depending on how the biotechnology goes, but probably 100, 150, 200 years, these bodies that we're in now are not going to exist. But the Atma is going to exist. So a very important question for us is, what happens to the Atma after it leaves the body? And the Bhagavad Gita explains that according to our thoughts, our activities during this lifetime and our thoughts at the time of death, we will attain another destination or another body. Because as long as we're in the material world, we will get a material body. But if our consciousness becomes completely spiritualized, then we don't take birth in the material world again, but we go to the spiritual realm and join the supreme and loving relationship. And that, in one sense, is the goal of life, to become free from this repetition of birth and death and all the miseries that accompany it. The Bhagavad Gita mentions specifically birth, death, old age, and disease. These cannot be eliminated by any material means. And we should always be conscious of them. Otherwise, we're sort of living in a fool's paradise. That, you know, oh, everything's okay, you know. It's not okay. In the sense that we have to suffer in so many different ways. So, so Krishna is God, accepted as the Supreme, and he is the original Guru. You've heard the word Guru. Guru means teacher. And especially spiritual teacher. I mean, there could be other types of gurus, but here we're interested in spiritual teachers. And he gives us this knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita. And what we're celebrating, the appearance day of Lord Nityananda. Lord Nityananda is considered also to be the original guru in the sense that he not only teaches us about spiritual knowledge, but he exemplifies what he teaches. Because Krishna is the Supreme, he shows us what it's like to be the Supreme. But that's useful so that we know who we're developing our relationship with. But Nityananda, he comes as a yogi, as a devotee, And he shows us how to realize our original spiritual nature and revive our relationship with Krishna. And in this present age, the recommended method is to chant a mantra. You've all heard the word mantra. Can anyone tell me what you understand to be a mantra? What a mantra is?
Chanting God's name.
Yes, that's the best kind of mantra. Man means mine, and tra means which delivers, that which delivers. So our minds in our materialistic life are enmeshed in many materialistic thoughts which disturb us. People want peace of mind. It's very common. Everyone wants peace of mind, actually. So mantra delivers the mind from this material entanglement. And how it works is this. Specifically, we chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Nityananda chanted the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra consists of three names of God, Hare, Krishna, and Rama. Hare actually means the feminine aspect of God. Well, if you look at the very top there, you'll see in the oval frames, on the left is Krishna, and on the right is Radha. And together, they are the most complete manifestation of the Supreme, both male and female. And when we chant Hare Krishna, the Hare refers to Radha and the Krishna refers to Krishna. Now, in the material world, the name of a thing and the thing are different. This is the relative world. So if I chant mango, 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 mango. Well, just chanting mango, mango isn't going to satisfy my desire for mango, because the word mango and the mango itself are different. But if I want Krishna, rather than Krishna, I chant Krishna, Krishna, Hare Krishna, because Krishna is actually present. Because in the absolute platform, there's no difference between the name of the thing and the thing. So you chant Krishna, Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna is actually present. He's dancing on your tongue. So this is the method. So in a nutshell, Vedic knowledge is divided into three categories. One is called Sambandha Gyan. That means knowledge of who we are, you know, what is the spiritual nature, what is the material nature, what is our relationship with them, who is the Supreme, what is our relationship with Him. Then Abhideya, and then Prayojana, that means the goal. And the goal is to revive our eternal relationship with the Supreme and ultimately go to the spiritual realm and engage in a loving relationship with Him or with them. And then Abhideya means the process. What is the process by which we achieve that goal? And the process in general terms is bhakti yoga. And in the various practices of bhakti yoga, the most important is the chanting of God's name. So Nityananda came and he taught that and he exemplified that process. And he is very, very merciful. And I'm going to read. It's quite an advanced book. It's Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. But you're advanced students, so we will read from an advanced book. So it is said, Yasya Prasada Bhagavat Prasada, by the mercy of the Guru, one gets the mercy of Krishna. And Nityananda is considered the original Guru. So the author of this book relates his personal experience, how by the mercy of Nityananda, he achieved Krishna. And, you know, I'm going to read this because it's there and you're advanced students. But when one becomes very advanced spiritually, he does not consider himself to have good qualities. Although he's full of good qualities, but that one of those qualities is humility. And out of humility, he thinks he has no good qualities. And in that mood, one can attract mercy. You know, if you think, you know, I'm great, well, you're not going to attract much mercy because you're not humble. But if you're humble, you will. It's sort of like the negative attracts the positive. You know, if you're down here, then you attract the mercy from up there. So the author here, he says, referring to Nityananda, because he is intoxicated by ecstatic love, because he's in the mood of a devotee, intoxicated with ecstatic love, and is an incarnation of mercy. He does not distinguish between the good and the bad, which is good for us, because we're all bad, to some extent. Not you, but most of us. But it doesn't even really matter, because he doesn't distinguish between who is good and who is bad. He gives his mercy to everyone. So if you're good, that's good, and if you're bad, that's also not bad. He delivers all those who fall down before him. So this is where the humility comes. That if you're proud, then you're not going to, prostrate yourself, or and beg for mercy. That's the real qualification, just to be humble. And then the author goes on and explains all the spiritual benefits he got by the mercy of Nityananda. So coming to my story, someone asked about my story. As I said, we could start a long time ago, probably billions of years ago, but we'll start with this lifetime. We can begin in high school. In high school, I mean, I always had the idea of doing good for people. And in high school, my idea of doing good for people was to become a doctor. And there was a club, sort of like the Future Doctors Association. So I was the president of the club. And then when I got to college, university, I went to Brandeis University, which is outside of Boston. I saw people who were suffering a lot, not because of physical ailments, but because of mental torture. Like, I had a friend, I didn't realize it at the time, but later I understood, like, he was suffering from depression, but he was really suffering, but there was nothing wrong with him physically. So then my concept of how to do good for others shifted. I thought, well, if someone can be healthy physically, but mentally they can be very tortured. And so I became a psychology major. And but that department of psychology was a little different. The chairman of the department was named Abraham Maslow. And he was developing what he called a third force in psychology. Up until then, there were two predominant schools in psychology. One was behaviorism, which was like stimulus and response, studied mainly rats, Pavlov's dog. And then there was psychoanalysis, which studied diseased people. So Maslow thought, instead of studying rats or studying diseased people, he would study healthy people. And he... Anyway, he had, some good ideas, and the whole department was sort of oriented towards what he called self-actualization, like realizing your full potential. And they invited many swamis and yogis. So, all right, I was a psychology major, but after a while I started to see that within the department there were the same sort of frailties that you would find anywhere else. You know, there was sort of competition for positions, for budget and appointments, and then once Professor Maslow, it was a real nice thing that it was really nice that he said it. I mean, I really respect him. But he described that once he was having these different symptoms, and he really didn't know what was going on with him. So he consulted a colleague, and the colleague said, "You're having an anxiety attack." And he told us, the students, that he had written chapters and books about anxiety attacks, but when he was having one, he didn't recognize it. So there's like a difference between like theoretical knowledge and realized knowledge. So everything put together, I thought that psychology is not the ultimate answer. So then I started to explore spirituality. And at that time, you know, I came to the conclusion or the understanding that I needed a guru, that in order to progress, I needed a guru. So then my focus became, you know, how to find my guru. And most of the, you know, swamis and yogis were of the impersonal school. Now, this is also a very important distinction. I've mentioned the Supreme, but within realization of the Supreme, there are actually three, you could say, degrees of realization. One is called Brahman, and that's like an impersonal spiritual light. And one is called Paramatma, and that is the Lord within the heart. But the ultimate spiritual realization is Bhagavan or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or Krishna. So almost all the swamis and yogis, and then there were also the Zen masters, and they all had an impersonal conception of the goal. In other words, their idea was to merge and become one with the light, or to sort of disappear into the void. And that was pretty much everyone. So I was going to see different swamis and yogis and masters. And, you know, I was looking for my guru, my perfect master. And I went through quite a long list. And I won't I won't tell you their names, and I won't describe my experiences with them, only because of lack of time. Although I do feel those interactions were very instructive. But in each case, I felt, no, this is not my perfect master. This is not my perfect master. This is not my perfect master. To the point where I became almost hopeless. I'm never going to find my perfect master. So, one evening, I had some friends over to my apartment for dinner. I was already vegetarian by then. So, you know, we had pasta, salad, soup, bread. And then afterwards we were going to go to see a movie. And in those days, there were theaters called art houses. Now everything is different. DVDs, they didn't exist then. And yeah, it was very different. So if you wanted to see a movie, you had to go to a theater. Unless by chance they were showing some old movie on television. But for like art movies, you didn't get to see on television very much. So anyway, we were going to Harvard Square to see a film. And just as we were about to leave, I remembered a poster that I had seen on campus, which read lecture, Bhagavad Gita as it is, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. But by then I was so discouraged in my search, I didn't even pay attention. Oh, it's just going to be another one. It's going to be another one. But that night, I remembered that poster, and I remembered that lecture was coming up. So, and something inside of me was like prompting me, you must go. So I told my friends that I want to go to this lecture. And I said, well, you know, we were all set, we're going to go to the movie. I said, well, okay. We can go to the late show. We'll go to the lecture first. And one of them, a lady, she was like really upset. Somehow, all of them, she was really upset. And she said, you know, why can't you be like a normal person? Why do you always have to be, you know, running after these swamis and yogis? And I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to upset anyone, didn't want to upset her. And I sort of tried to acquiesce and go along with their idea. But something inside of me just was pushing me. And so finally I told her, okay, this will be the last one I ever go to. And so we went to the campus, and Swami Bhaktivedanta was on the stage. It was in the auditorium, actually, of the psychology department. And because of all this discussion, we were late, but there was a kirtan going on. You know what kirtan is? Who knows what kirtan is?
No.
Yes.
A rhythmic tune about God, singing songs about God.
Yes. Yes. There are two ways of chanting. One is called japa. That's done quietly, mainly for your own self to hear. And the other is kirtan, and that's done loudly, usually like with musical accompaniment. And so so in the auditorium, they were having kirtan. They're singing the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And one by one, students from the audience were getting out of their seats and jumping up on the stage and joining the singing and dancing. So I stood up. I also felt like going up and joining them, but I had all these friends on both sides of me. And we already went through a lot just to get to the auditorium. And I thought, if I were to just jump up on the stage, that would probably be too much for them. That would probably be the end. So I just stood up and sort of swayed in place. And then afterwards, one of the devotees announced that if anyone is going to Boston or Cambridge, Harvard Square, they should meet the devotees in the lobby because the devotees need a ride. Because they didn't own any motor vehicles. So we were going to Cambridge, to Harvard Square. And I had a station wagon. Do you have station wagons these days? Yeah, so something like an SUV. So there was some space. And so, the devotees came in and I took them to Harvard Square, got the address to the temple, and then went the next night. And after the lecture, I asked Bhaktivedanta Swami, this is really the question that was burning within me, that there are so many swamis and yogis, and each one says that his method is the best. Each one is teaching a different process, and each one says that his method is the best. So how do I know which is actually the best? And Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, he replied very intelligently, "What is your goal?" I was asking, what is the best means? But there's a more basic question, what is your goal? So he said, do you want to serve God or do you want to become God? And then he went on to explain that if you want to become God, that means you're not God now. And how can not God become God? He said, God is God. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God by yoga or meditation. And then he said, Krishna is God. He's always God. He's God when he's on the lap of Yashoda. He's God when he's speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God. And then he said, if you sow the seed of service to God and water it by chanting, God will give all the favorable elements, sunshine and everything, to make the plant grow. But if you want to become God, so you're saying if you want to serve God, God will help you, but if you want to become God, you're only cheating yourself, because why should God help the competition? So he said you can become godly, but you cannot become God. And that was a revelation. That was a revelation. And then I knew I had found my perfect master, and then I surrendered. I submitted myself as his student, his disciple. And so that was in maybe March, spend March, April 1969. So I've been attempting to, serve him, serve his instructions, serve his mission ever since then. Someone asked about my travels. Actually, every place is wonderful, because the Atma within every body is the same. I mean, it's individual. It's not that we're all individuals, but they're the same in the sense that they're all spiritual beings, and they're all by nature divine. So in that sense, it's wonderful wherever. I mean, I remember going to Africa the first time I got to, chant with the Africans, like the tribal. It was really blissful, seeing them chant and dance. And, some places were more dangerous than others. I think probably the most dangerous place for me was Pakistan. There was one time I really thought this could be the end. But, we survived. Krishna saved us. Even there, we found so many nice people. I mean, really nice people. And, Facebook is an amazing thing. I mean, I'm not recommending it. Fairly new to it myself, but it's an amazing thing, because we had a friend in Karachi. He was a poet, he was an intellectual, and he was translating this Bhagavad Gita into Urdu language, which is the national language of Pakistan, somewhat akin to Hindi. And so he had a magazine, and in every issue of the magazine, he would run an installment from the Bhagavad Gita, as it is. And somehow, he was like too liberal for some people. And one day they just, came into his office and shot him dead, which was, quite... He was a friend, so that was a blow, and on top of it, he was very helpful. But the reason I mentioned Facebook is because his grandson somehow saw me on Facebook and recognized me as being one of the Hare Krishna devotees who would visit his grandfather. And so, yeah, we had some exchange, and he's, as you can imagine, you know, very, very open, and it was very nice to make that that connection. So sometimes we may not, you know, we're all sort of working towards some greater mission, and you know, we're not going to see our mission completed in our lifetime. You know, it's a very big mission, but we can do what we can, and then the succeeding generations will carry on. So yeah, I mean, people, yeah, I mean, there's so many places I visited, but I think it really comes down to that the Atma is of the same nature within all the different varieties of bodies, different varieties of culture, and underneath it all, they're, you know, divine, they're parts and parcel of Krishna, and with the proper association, their original love for Krishna will be awakened. And I've just seen it everywhere. There's not any place where people have not responded. And yeah, I've been to, you know, Russia, China, so that this godlessness is actually quite artificial, and yeah, it doesn't satisfy anyone really. It's sort of like one of my colleagues said that the people who claim to be atheists, if you really speak with them, they're not really atheists, but they have issues with God. And so their way of you know, dealing with their issues with God is like, he doesn't exist, there is no God. But if there is no God, why did they spend so much time talking about him and arguing about him? You know, say, Tinkerbell. You know who Tinkerbell is? I don't even know if I remember, but she's a fictional character in Peter Pan, the story of Peter Pan. So now, okay, let's say Tinkerbell doesn't exist. But nobody's making it on a campaign like, there's no Tinkerbell. But there are people who are on a big crusade, you know, there is no God. But why? And I think the psychology is that underneath it all, they have some issues with God, and that's how they express themselves in a, you know, not a very positive way. But this struggle is, this struggle, you could say, between the theists and atheists goes back to the beginning of time. And I mention it because today's a special day, although tomorrow's a very special day. Actually, today's also a very special day, because it's a day, it's called Varaha Dvadasi. It's a day when a very big atheist was vanquished by one of the forms of God. But that's the absolute nature of God. Even if he kills someone, they get liberated. So, you know, anyone who comes in touch with the Supreme, with the Absolute in any way, he gets a very wonderful result. So this big atheist, he was killed by this incarnation called Varaha. But being killed by him, he was liberated. It means free from the cycle of birth and death. So, yeah. So somehow or other, you know, come to Krishna, come to God. Of course, he is known by different names in different cultures, and it's the same Supreme. But the beauty of Krishna consciousness is there's more detail, there's more information. Like any bona fide religion will say you should love God. I mean, that's true, that is the goal of life, to love God. But if you ask them, who is God, they don't have a clear conception, and you can't really love someone if you don't know the person. I mean, you can have a vague sense of appreciation, but you can't really love someone unless you know them. So this, you know, it's like advanced literature. It begins with the Bhagavad Gita, and there's a lot, you know, just in the Bhagavad Gita, and then there are even other books with more details, and then you can really learn about God, and, you know, how kind he is, how merciful he is, how loving he is, and how you can, you know, develop your loving relationship with him. And that's, you know, that's the goal of life. And then at the same time, it's also service to God to help others come to him. It's a service to them, and it's a service to the Supreme. And I asked that question to Srila Prabhupada, because as I mentioned, I was interested in doing good for others. And after meeting him, I came to understand the importance of serving God. So after one of the talks he gave, because he was in Boston for about 2 weeks, so every night I would go. And so I asked him that, you know, I've understood the importance of serving God from you, but where does service to man come in? And he replied that if you give something to someone, that makes that person so satisfied that he doesn't want anything else. Is that not service? And he gave one example from Vedic histories. There was a young boy. He's actually only 5 years old, but his stepmother was saying that he couldn't. His father was a king, but his stepmother was saying he couldn't become a king because he wasn't born from her womb. So he went to his mother and told her what happened, and, you know, he wanted the kingdom, and his mother said, "Well, your father favors your stepmother, and I don't think there's anything I can do." "Well, who can help me?" "Well, only God can help me." So he went into the... "Oh yeah, so where is God?" "Well, many people look for God in the forest." So he went into the forest, and in the way of a five-year-old, he was looking for God, you know, looking in the bushes, looking behind the logs, looking in the trees. But God is in everyone's heart. he saw that this boy is very sincere to find me. So he sent a guru. And from within the heart of the guru, he sent the guru to the forest to meet the boy. The guru gave him a mantra. And, you know, by following the guru's instructions and chanting the mantra, the chanting the name of God, eventually God came to him, came to see him. And so then God, at the end, God asked him that, I want to give you some benediction, what do you want? And he said, I don't want anything. And God said, but what about your kingdom? You came, you did all this for your kingdom. And the boy replied that, yes, that's true. But that kingdom was like a piece of broken glass. And now I've gotten you, who are like the most precious jewel. So I'm a million times satisfied. I don't want any benediction from you. So Srila Prabhupada said that to give someone that he's so satisfied that he doesn't want anything else, you know, is that not service? And he also told the story of Alexander the Great. You heard of Alexander the Great? So he was conquering everywhere, and he came to the precincts of India, and he saw a yogi in meditation in the hot sun. And he was like very impressed. He never saw anyone like that before. So he got down from his carrier and he approached the yogi and he said, I'm very impressed with you. And I want to give you something. I'm Alexander the Great. I'm the conqueror of the world. I'll give you whatever you want. And he said, I want only one thing. Please move aside. You're blocking the sun. Now that sun was beating down on him. It was like very hot. But that was his, like, that was his austerity to realize God. So who was Alexander the Great? He couldn't give him anything. He just didn't want him to get it in the way of his yogic practice. And then Alexander the Great sent a message back to his troops that were following behind that these people are very special here, don't mess with them. So Srila Prabhupada was saying, to give someone that, you know, is that not service? That they're so satisfied, they don't want anything else. So, I mean, he elaborated more, but that was the idea, and I realized, yes, this is the best service. Oh, it's not, of course, we are benefiting, but sharing it with others, they will also benefit, and that will also please the Supreme, because ultimately he wants everyone to be happy. And he knows this is really the only way they can be completely happy and satisfied. So thank you very much. Do we have time for questions? I think it's part of the program. Yes.
So you want to help others? How is it that you do that?
Well, if they, if they come to understand, first of all, that they're not the body, then, see, this is a problem that most people think they're the body. Now, if you ask anyone who who are you? They'll say, I'm so-and-so, I'm American, I'm Chinese, I'm Indian, I'm black, white, male, female. They identify with the body. And because they identify with the body, their concept of their self-interest is in relation to the body. So it's just, Srila Prabhupada gives the example, if you're doing a mathematical calculation and you make a mistake in the first step, then even if you perform every other step perfectly, you may end up further and further from the final solution because you made a mistake in the first step. So people, if they make a mistake in the first step of who they are, and they think they're the body, and then they do everything for the body, they may end up getting further away from the real happiness that they want. So if we can help people to understand they're not the body, but they're the Atma within the body, and that the Atma is part of the Supreme, related to the Paramatma, then they can become happy. And we can, you know, give them a book, we can invite them to a discussion. You know, there are different ways that we can, you know, interest them. That was a very good question. Does that answer it?
Not a question, but more kind of a comment. So are you trying to say that you help other people kind of in a way of helping them realize who they truly are, not just, you know, the appearance or, like you said, the body, but more of this kind of the soul or the, you know, mm-hmm. what you were saying. So just pretty much trying to help people kind of help them self-discover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's nice. In fact, one of the books of our teacher's writings is called The Journey of Self-Discovery. Yeah. Yes?
Kind of binding back to my original question, when you gave us an example of a water in a cloud being so pure, and the moment it touches the ground, it becomes contaminated. It's similar to how we are, like when we are Atma, when we are in a spiritual body, we are pure, and when we enter into the materialistic body or the body itself, the physical body, we kind of go in search of what is the spiritual, what is purity, and how we can elevate this spiritual soul and pray God and mantras, kirtans, bhajans, shlokas, and all those things. My question is, if the Atma itself is pure, then why does it have to enter into a physical body and go in search of a Paramatma, an elevated soul?
That's a very good question. It's a very good question. It's very hard to trace when the living entity comes into the material world. And it's very hard to know why the living entity comes into the material world. But somehow we got here. And some of our teachers have said that how the living entity becomes conditioned by the material nature cannot really be understood by the conditioned soul. But when you are liberated from the material conditioning, you can get a sense of how the soul became conditioned by the material nature. But Srila Prabhupada also said it's like you're someone is drowning in the ocean, and a boat comes to rescue that person. And the person says, well, wait a minute, how did I get here? Well, yeah, that's not such an important question. The thing is, you are here, and you're floundering, you're subject to this birth, death, old age, and disease, and so many miseries. So you want to get on the boat and be taken to safety. A very sort of simple or basic answer is that the living entity has minute independence, free will. Because, love is voluntary. If there's force, there's no love. Love is voluntary. Voluntary means there's free will, there's choice. And free will means you can use your free will properly or misuse it. So, somehow, we have misused our free will and come into the material world. So now we want to properly use our free will to serve the Supreme, which is what we're meant to do, and get out of the material world. And I should also clarify that get out of the material world doesn't necessarily mean that you leave it physically. The example is given of the lotus, that the roots are in the mud, but the stem goes through the water and the flower is above the water. So, a pure devotee like Srila Prabhupada, he was in the material world externally, but internally he was not in the material world. So that's, it's like, we're here, somehow we made a mistake somewhere along the line, and we're here.
Can you ask another question?
Okay.
One last question.
Okay, last.
I kind of defer to, when you say that we kind of did some mistake, or deviated from when we were in the free will and we got into materialistic and wandering ourselves in search of elevating our spiritual. So my question is, how can we go or deviate from the free will when we are in the spiritual realm? Because all we know is ultimate God or ultimate love or unconditional essence of love when we are in free will.
But what is the meaning of free will if you can't misuse it?
Yeah, the question is, how can we misuse it when we are
because
not
you have free
in a
will.
Materialistic world?
There's a very fine point, which is envy. And, when we become envious of of God and want to take his position, then we come in the material world and suffer. Now, you know, how could envy appear there? I don't know.
Pretty well.
I mean, how, it's interesting that Srila Prabhupada, you can ask like, who, where, why, but you can't ask how. If I ask you, how, I mean, of course we're in the company of biology students, but still, if I ask you how is your hair growing? I mean, they can describe it, but they don't exactly explain how. You know, they might even have mathematical calculations, but doesn't exactly explain how. I think this is my personal recommendation. You should go to the temple tomorrow. Are you going?
I don't know. I'm not going to what temple.
Where I have to go. Anyway, either there or here or anywhere, you should fall down at the feet of Nityananda Prabhu and tell him what your dilemma is, what your perplexity is, what your doubt is, and ask him to help you.
Definitely.
Okay.
I ask that every day. Sorry. But I ask what every day? I ask this question every day because I'm so confused and so
okay.
Deeply.
Okay, yeah. I understand that. So now we're adding something to the formula. And that is that you fall down at the feet of Nityananda Prabhu and ask him to. Because you've been going around in circles in your mind. So now we have to go beyond that. You need like some special mercy.
Yeah. I definitely need that.
So that's why Nityananda Prabhu came, to give that special mercy.
Thank you.
That's inherently part of achieving that enlightenment, is that right? It's part of the work that you have to put in?
Yes. Any success requires two ingredients, our effort and Krishna's mercy. If we think, I can do it on my own, I can figure it out on my own, we can't. But if we think, I'm not going to do anything, I'm just going to sit and wait for Krishna to do everything, that's also not. So our effort, is a necessary component, but it's not sufficient. We need both our effort and God's mercy. Yes, Radhika?
I had a question coming back to the point of free will. So we often hear that we have the free will to make our decisions. And then we also hear that we should just surrender onto God's plan. So does God have a plan for us, or are we following his plan based on what he wants us to do, or do we have the free will to be responsible for our own actions? Because there's the idea of fate and destiny, that we're destined to do something with our life, but then as you mentioned, we have the free will to make that decision because we were envious of God, we came to this material world, and because of that, we have the free will to choose our path. But then you hear, you know, devotees telling others, you should just surrender unto God's plan because He knows best. So, do we have free will or do we not? Or how does that really work?
Well, surrendering to God doesn't mean we give up our free will. It just means that we give preference to God's desire. Just like it happens quite often with parents, that they may have one desire, but the child may have another desire. And they give in to what the child wants. That's why we have Sunday school. The children want to come to Sunday school, so then the parents have to come. I mean, they don't have to. They have their free will. But out of love, they come because that's what the child wants to do. So surrender is based on love. It means we love Krishna, so we want to do what He wants us to do. We still have our free will, but we consider His happiness, you know, more important than our so-called happiness. And by making Him happy, then we really find our own happiness. But we always have free will. Yeah.
I have a question. Why is God always termed as He and not she?
It's a convention. As I mentioned earlier, the complete conception of God is both male and female. But we don't want to say it, because that sounds impersonal. And we don't want to say them, because it could sound like we're worshiping many gods, but we're not actually worshiping many gods. We're worshiping one God that has a male and a female aspect. So it's just a convention that we say Him, because we don't want to say it and we don't want to say them. We could say her, if that makes you happy. But it is, it's Radha and Krishna. It's the two of them together are the Supreme. All right, I guess we can... Did you have one? Okay, so we can proceed.
Sure. I'd like to thank Govinda Giriraj Maharaj for giving such an insightful talk.